Yesterday we tried a very simple variational class of states, a matrix. It's a product state, no entanglement in it. And what we saw, this is the corresponding diagram with the tensor network with no bound indices. We saw that the cost was linear in n, so we could deal with n very large. We could deal with many sites, a very large system. But we saw that it had serious drawbacks. The first one is that there are no correlations in the system. The connected correlator between two points was equal to zero. Okay. Also, there was no entanglement. Entanglement entropy was zero, right? And so what we did was a quick fix for that. We connected the product state to a quantum circuit of depth t. T is the number of rows of gates. So what we're trying to do here is to throw in some entanglement into the system so that the resulting state is no longer a product state, but it has some amount of entanglement. And then what we saw is that this was possible. But the cost of manipulating these ansatz grew exponentially. That's n e to the t exponentially in the number of rows of gates that we included. But at the very least, it did what we wanted. Then the correlations were non-zero, at least for short distances. We had non-trivial correlations at short distances. And similarly, the entropy was no longer zero. It was increasing. It could increase with the size of the interval that we are looking at, but it would saturate eventually to a constant. And this occurred at distances of the order t, and the amount of entropy was also proportional to t. So some of us were not very happy about this because we thought, well, this could be maybe a good ansatz for ground states of gap systems, because in one dimension, because we see that the correlations decay exponentially anyway, so we are just neglecting a small tail there in having that after some distance the correlation would be zero here. And the saturation of the entropy is what we observe anyway in a gap, in the ground state of a gap system in 1D. So, but we were very unhappy about this exponential growth. So today I will tell you about a simple tensor network that does not have that works very well for gap systems of one-dimensional, for ground states of one-dimensional Hamiltonians with a gap. Okay, and the name of this is matrix product state, or in short MPS, and I'll be using MPS or matrix product state through the lecture. And let's start with the definition. So again, what we have here is state of a lattice of n sites. Each side takes the different, is described by the d-dimensional Hilbert space. And what we want to do is to represent the whole wave function, these are d to the n coefficients, in some way, such that we don't take so many values. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to represent states that can be expressed in the following way. Again, I'm going to use diagrams. So I'm going to represent all these complex coefficients as a product of tensors that are connected in one-dimension fashion, following just the, if this is a one-dimensional system, I'm just following the geometry of the lattice. I'm putting together tensors in one dimension. Okay? And I will actually consider both this option, which I will call MPS with open boundary conditions, from now on, where by this I just mean that this tensor is not connected with this one. I will also consider, though, the option where the first tensor and the last one are also connected through a bound index. Okay. So first of all, why do we call, and this is going to be MPS with periodic boundary conditions. Or periodic boundary conditions. And actually, you can see that open boundary conditions is something we obtain if we take, it's contained within this class, right? In this class, if we take this bond index connecting the first and last tensor to have only one value, to take only one value, then we recover the open boundary condition case. OK, so why do we call this matrix product state? Maybe the best is to give a simple example where let's suppose we have five sides, and let's just work out explicitly what we are saying about the wave function here. So in this case, I'll have five tensors, A, B, C, D, and E. Okay. I'm assuming periodic boundary conditions. And now, if I want to know, so remember that these indices take d values each, right? So I1 goes from 1 to d. So suppose that I'm interested in a particular coefficient, psi, for the wave function. So say, I don't know, to follow, right? So say I1, 1, which one is this? 2, 1, and 3. Okay, so I've just specified these indices here. Okay, so that means I come here and I just put a 1, 1, 2, 1, and 3. Okay, so on this side also I come and I specify this to be 1, 1, 2, 1, and 3. Now remember, if we have a tensor with three indices, right? This is alpha, this is beta, and we specify this index, say, to be a 1. This turns into a matrix, right? So what we have here, effectively, let me put, just to remember which number we had, let me put it up here. What we have in this expression is that once we specify the physical indices to take given values, we obtain a product of matrices with the trace, right? So this is nothing but the trace of A1 times B2 times C2, sorry, B1, C2, D1, and E3. Okay? So we've written our wave function in such a way that every time we specify the physical indices, every time we're going to compute a specific complex amplitude for the wave function in this expansion here, what we have to do is to compute the trace of a product of matrices. That's why we call it matrix product state. Right?
Sorry, so these numbers 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, are they labels or particular?
No. So values? What I was saying is that the wave function we have psi I1, I2, I3, I4, I5, right? Where these guys, these indices I1 can take values from 1 to D. I2 can take values from 1 to D, etc. Right? So in total, we have D to the N complex coefficients here. Let's try to compute one of these complex coefficients. Right? OK, so how do we do this? Well, first, we specify the values of these indices. And for instance, we could have that the first index has value 1, the second index, right? So this means I1 equal to 1. I2 equal to 1, I3 equal to 2, I4 equal to 1, I5 equal to 3, right? That's a particular complex amplitude in this wave function. And what I'm saying is that once you've fixed all these values, right, once you've decided the value of each index, of each physical index, then you are left with an evaluation to find this amplitude that consists of taking the trace of a product of matrices. Okay?
Are any specification on the dimension of those matrices? Or each bond index can be anything that I want? Or
at this point, we didn't specify. So it could be large, it could be small. I'll go into that No.
But they don't need to be the same at each point.
They don't have to be the same. So these matrices may not be square matrices. They can be rectangular matrices. Right? So in the end, what I'm saying is that we had the tensor, which had three indices. And for each value of the index, it produces a matrix. Right? And so when we want to specify a complex amplitude for the wave function, we just compute the stage of the product of matrices. All right, so it turns out that this, in relation to your question, that this matrix product state structure is generic in the sense that you can represent that we can actually represent any state in the whole, any state of the Hilbert space using a matrix product state using this tensor network. And therefore, the trick will be that we'll have to put some limitation on the Bohn index in order to obtain a useful variational class. But first, let's look at a matrix product state for a generic psi in this tensor product. Right? For a generic state of the lattice. And so following with the example of just having five legs, what I can do now is, so this is psi, these are the exponentially many complex amplitude. Now what I can do is I can look at the singular value decomposition with respect to the partition where I take one side, the first spin or side on one side and then the rest on the other. Okay? So this Schmidt decomposition or singular value decomposition that we studied last week allow us to decompose this. We just look at this index as being one index and we put together the rest of indices that defines a matrix. We can computed singular value decomposition, and we will end up with something that looks like this. Okay, where this is U, unitary matrix, this is S, the diagonal matrix with the singular values, and this is another unitary matrix. Okay? And you agree that, so this is just the singular value decomposition of this matrix, right? Where I identify all these four indices, and then these indices are put together, and then I just split them again. No problem there. Right? But now what I can do is I can also realize that it is trivial from here. That if I multiply this back by V, and then V dagger, that nothing has happened here, right? V dagger V gives an identity in the relevant space, and then V dagger brings us back to where we were. So all I'm saying is that I can multiply my wave function by V dagger without changing it, right? So I'm going to do this here. I'm going to say this is equal to psi V dagger. Okay. And then I just multiply these guys together. I'm not worrying at all about computational cost here. And I obtain, right, if I multiply these tensors together, I obtain something like this. Right? I've broken the wave function into two tensors, the product of two tensors. But now I can go and look at the singular value decomposition of, according to the partition 1, 2, and 3, 4, and 5. Okay? So this corresponds to looking at the wave function and thinking, putting these three indices together, these two indices together, and singular value decomposing it. So what do I obtain? I obtain something similar as in the previous case, but now this is U prime S prime and V prime dagger, where what we've changed is the number of indices on each side. Right? Part A now has two indices and B three. But, but here again, this, by what I argued before, this is the same as U prime S prime V dagger times V dagger. Okay? So using that, using the fact that I can come to the wave function and multiply it by V times V dagger without changing anything, I come here and do precisely that. I multiply it by, so this is, this was V prime, V prime, V prime. I come here, multiply it by V prime and V prime dagger. Okay? And I just multiply these two guys together to obtain the next step in this decomposition. So this, this tensor corresponds to the product of those two. Okay? And now you, you just keep doing this. Right? So if you want equal to dot, 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 equal to that. Okay? You just iterate. What we're doing here is we're applying a sequence of singular valley decompositions or Schmidt decompositions for all possible bipartitions that take a number of indices to the left and to the right. And we just do this progressively. All right? So we just shown that any state can be written as a matrix product state. All right? So unless we introduce some level of restriction, that's not going to be very useful to simulate, to efficiently represent the wave functions. Let's see what we have to do then to turn this into a useful tensor network. MPS as a variational many-body state. So again, I insist that say suppose we have six sites in our system, then remember that we had a way of assessing what was the, in a generic case, what was the Schmidt rank that we expected. So if I take a partition here, right, I can regard this as a D-level system. And on the other side, we have n minus 1 copies of this D-level system. So clearly, the Schmidt rank, which was upper bounded by the smallest of the dimensions on A and B, remember that? Schmidt rank, K was at most the minimum, right, of the dimension in part A and the dimension in part B. Well, in this case, part A has dimension D, and part B has dimension D to the n minus 1, right? So clearly, at most, this is going to be the rank of this index, which is the Schmidt rank, right, is at most D. Right? We go to the next cut, and we realize now we have D square and D to the n minus 2. Okay, so this at most, the Schmidt rank is going to be D square. And you can progress, and at this point you get D to the 3, but then when you keep going, this is D to the 2 at most, and D. So if we select randomly a state in the Hilbert space, we expect a profile of one dimensions in the MPS form. It will be D, D square, D3, D square, and D. Okay. So if we look at that then, say for n, for a generic n, which I'm going to suppose that it's even, then we would have this MPS. We'll get to the middle. And again, we'll have that this index takes the values for a generic case, the square. And in the middle here, we would have d to the n half. Okay. And this index here is d to the n half minus 1. So if we take just this tensor and we have a look at it, right, this index takes d values. This index takes d to the n half minus 1 values. And this index takes d to the n half values. So the size of this tensor, the number of elements in this tensor, is the product of these dimensions. And it's d to the n. Okay, so this just writing this single tensor is as expensive as writing the whole wave function. So we didn't gain anything. Okay. We can use the MPS just as a canonical way of writing a wave function without making any kind of approximation. Is this clear? So the MPS, in general, does not give us an efficient way of specifying a wave function. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that the bond dimension, which I'm going to call chi, okay, is we're going to assume that it's independent of n. It's equal to a constant. See, in a generic case, this bond dimension was taking d to the n over 2 minus 1 values. This means that the bond dimension depends on n, exponentially, by the way. Right. So what we're going to do is we're going to just consider that chi, instead, is a constant. It does not depend on the number of sides. So for instance, it could be, say, 10. Okay. So what we're doing is the following. Again, we have the whole Hilbert space, which is very large. This is the CD to the n. And now what we're going to do is we're going to consider wave functions that can be written with chi equal to 10. So as an MPS with one dimension equal to 10. And this will only give us some small submanifold there. Okay. But then, so this could be MPS with one dimension 10. But then what we could do is we could consider, so imagine that these are the states that we can represent now with this restriction. Now we could consider larger bond dimension, say 20, okay? And this will give us more. So that's chi equal to 20, okay? And what we know is that if we keep increasing this bond dimension and all the way to bond dimension equal to d to the n over 2, then we can cover the whole Hilbert space. Okay? But let's go back to thinking about what happens if we restrict our one dimension to just a constant. In this case, what we have is that each tensor has one dimension chi and chi one indices, and the physical index takes the values. So the size of this is now chi squared d. Okay, each tensor has chi squared times d coefficients, and you saw this guy yesterday in the tutorial. Then, if we take n such tensors, so n MPS tensors, each tensor with this number of parameters gives us a number of parameters, which is n chi squared d. Okay? So we have here our variational ansatz, which depends only on order n parameters. The number of parameters, if we fix chi, only grows linearly in n. Okay, and so now we just want to quickly review things that you saw yesterday. Right, during the tutorial about the computational cost of manipulating an MPS. So let's have a look at our list of properties. The first one was of for a tensor network to be useful, efficient specification. And we say this is order chi squared d times n. Okay, so we're good. Now, let's look at part B, efficient manipulation. Someone without Spanish background, do you put an E here? No, okay. And I won't put an E here. So efficient manipulation, then this is something that you had yesterday, and what you were computing, I believe, is the scalar product. We're going to use matrix product state with open boundary conditions. And what you discussed yesterday was how to contract this scalar product. Okay? And what you saw is that you can do that with cost that is linear in n, cubic in chi, and linear in d. Okay? And specifically, what you had to realize was that we had, let's use now color to denote the bond index, to differentiate it from the physical index, physical indices. So what we have is this type of a step where we have some tensor, and we want to multiply it with two of the MPS tensors, and we can do this stepwise by multiplying these two together first. And this gives rise to so maybe violet is not the best color. So you obtain, you go from here to here by multiplying these two tensors together. You look at the cost of this multiplication, which is the product of dimensions of the indices involved. And this can be therefore accomplished with chi to the 3. There are three red indices involved in this multiplication times d, which is for the white index. And then we can multiply these two guys together. And this gives rise to this new tensor. And here, again, we're multiplying together two tensors with indices, three bond indices, so chi to the 3 and one physical index. Okay? And once you see this, you realize that this object is of the same type of this one. So you can iterate this process from left to right and go through the whole tensor network. This takes order. You have to do this n times. n times. So that justifies that it's this cost times n. Okay. But the important thing here, if you want to get the, I mean, there is this prefactor here, which we computed yesterday in the tutorial. But the important thing is that it does not depend on n. So the dependence on n is just linear. All right. So if we wanted, then you also saw that if you want to compute some correlator, some local observable, then these amounts to writing basically the same, but now you have to insert some metrics here corresponding to the local operator. But then you can get rid, or you can basically observe. You can multiply this matrix corresponding to the observable with an MPS tensor, right? And the cost in this case is just chi squared d squared. That's two bond indices and two physical indices involved in this multiplication. And then you go from here to a situation where this tensor has been changed. But then that looks formally identical to the calculation we just made. Okay, so what we see from here is that the extra cost of computing compared to the scalar product, adding a local observable in the middle, gives us an extra cost which is independent of n. And actually, if typically the bond dimension is going to be much larger than d, and so we care about the power in bond dimension chi, we see that it's just second power compared to third power. So this is for free. In practice, this comes for free. Okay. So we see that indeed with the matrix product state, we can efficiently compute the norm or expectation values of local observables. Okay. So are there questions on this? I'm assuming that was clear from yesterday. So let's have a look at the matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions. Let's have a look at the cost in that case, because that's going to be relevant later. So if we want to consider now periodic boundary conditions, we just have to come here. And add the extra bond index connecting the first and last tensors. And what this means in practice is that, What this means for this figure is that we need two extra indices. Which ends up meaning that here we replace the 3 with a 5. Okay, so with periodic boundary conditions, what we obtain is that the cost scales as, again, linear in n, and we just modify the power in the bond dimension. Okay. So again, it's under control. It's more expensive using periodic boundary conditions in the MPS results in a higher power of the bond dimension. So for one dimension equal to, 10, right, the periodic boundary condition will cost you 100 times more. So you want to think carefully what boundary conditions you want to use. It's, factor 100 in computational cost is significant. But still, it's not affecting the fact that the simulation is efficient in the number of sites. It's just linear in the number of sites. Now, using periodic boundary conditions offers some interesting possibility. Which is the following. I'm going to use the fact that sometimes we're interested in studying correlation invariant systems to try the following wave function. I'm just going to copy many times the same tensor. Okay, I'm going to try an MPS, matrix product state, with periodic boundary conditions. Okay. For the case of a translation invariant system. The motivation to use these answers is that we have introduced the same tensor everywhere, and automatically we realize that any expectation value is going to be translation invariant, right? So one may think, okay, maybe that's a good answer for translation invariant systems. What's interesting about these answers is that you can argue then that that you can take the thermodynamic limit for the following reasons. First, let's look at part A, so efficient specification. So what we see in this case is that we have completely specified the state of the n sites with just one tensor. Okay, we have many copies of it, but we don't need to store many copies of the same. So single tensor of size chi squared d, right? Well, that's the good news. There is no dependence on the system size. So we could, as far as storing the ansatz, we could consider an infinite system. Okay? We don't need to consider finite system anymore. Okay. Now, this would be the case if we knew how to manipulate these ansatz efficiently. But we do, and that's what I want to explain to you now. So we're going to consider first n to be large. So think about n being large, and this will allow us to actually introduce some approximations in our calculation, and then we'll take n to be infinite, and this will make this calculation exact. Okay? So what we're going to do next is we're going to take a matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions specified by a single tensor. So the goal is to write a wave function for a wave function which is translation invariant. And we're going to try and compute, say, the norm, right, with a cost that is independent of the system size. So what's the norm? What's the scalar product? Well, it's nothing but that drawing there. Okay, I'm there. So why not? Let's do this again. But I want you to pay attention to the following thing. We can write this. If we think of this elementary unit here, which I'm drawing again, this is A star. Okay, this is a linear map from the left to the right. Right, you specify some vector here, you multiply by this, you get another vector. So this is a matrix, and we're going to call this transfer matrix. It's a matrix if you put these indices together, of course. Right, but let me call this object transfer matrix. Transfer matrix T. Then what we're trying to do here is we're trying to compute the trace of this transfer matrix to the nth power. Okay? That's what this is. Yeah? So one option is to take this matrix and multiply it n times and then take the trace. But for large n, we will realize that there is some leading contribution, and then small corrections that we'll be able to neglect in the limit of n infinite. So how are we going to proceed? What we want to do is we take this matrix, the transfer matrix, T, and we're going to write it, we're going to write its eigenvalue decomposition. So this is going to be a sum from 1 to chi square. Remember that each index takes chi values. So these two indices together take chi square values. Right? And this is a linear map between chi square, between a vector space of dimension chi square and a vector space of dimension chi square. So we can compute the eigenvalue decomposition, okay, where what we have here is, these are the right eigenvalues, these are the left eigenvalues. And remember, T doesn't have to be Hermitian or have any other property. So in principle, these are not orthonormal bases. But what we have for any matrix is that the right and left eigenvalues are bi-orthogonal. They form a bi-orthogonal basis. Two bases which are bi-orthogonal in this sense. So this is the only relation we have here, okay? That the left eigenvalue, the left eigenvectors are bi-orthogonal to the right eigenvectors. Great. So then, if that's clear, what we can do is we can take T to the n. That's what we need the trace of, right? But once we have the eigenvalue decomposition, this is very easy to do. This is nothing but what you obtain by taking each eigenvalue to the nth power. Okay? Due to the fact that left and right eigenvectors are bi-orthogonal. Okay, and now what we're going to assume is that we have organized the eigenvalues. You can always organize them in decreasing order. Okay, and we're going to assume that actually the largest one is strictly larger. Okay, we're going to assume that the largest eigenvalue of this transfer matrix is strictly larger. And there are physical, this has physical implications or a physical meaning. If we had degeneracy here, we would be talking about a system with symmetry breaking order, okay? Where we can represent the two symmetry breaking ground states in the same matrix product state. But if we choose one of these, so let's assume for simplicity that we're studying a system where the ground state is non-degenerate, then you can see, one can see, I'm not going to show it to you now, but one can see that the largest eigenvalue is going to be, that the largest eigenvalue is not going to be degenerate, okay? And once we have this, then it's easy to argue that, you know, for large, so if we take the trace, if we take the trace of t to the n, that's basically lambda 1 to the n plus lambda 2 to the n, lambda 3 to the n, etc. But this is equal to lambda 1 to the n of 1 plus lambda 2 over lambda 1 to the n plus lambda 3 over lambda 1 to the n, etc. Okay, and the fact that lambda 1 was larger, was non-degenerate, implies that this thing here is decaying exponentially in n, okay? So this trace is basically lambda 1 to the n plus corrections that decay exponentially with n, right? So at this point, what we're going to do is we know that we want to take n to infinite, so we can neglect all these corrections, and we find that our trace is lambda 1 to the n. And now you have to decide whether you want your state to be normalized or not. If you want it to be normalized, you have to enforce that this is equal to 1. Okay? You can do that. You can just take this, you know, you can compute the transfer matrix, look at the largest eigenvalue, right? Take the square root of it and then divide each tensor by the square root of this value. So if I start with A, then I define my new A prime as A divided by the square root of lambda 1. If I look at A prime, then it will have lambda 1 prime equal to 1. Okay? You can always do that. So what I'm saying is that what we wanted to do was to normalize our wave function for the infinite system, and we can always do that. After which, and we can do that efficiently. We just had to compute the largest eigenvalue of this transfer matrix. This had nothing. This computation, computing the largest eigenvalue of the transfer matrix, can be done with a cost that is independent of n, of the system size. Okay. So, in the presence of translation invariance, then we can use these ansatz and computation of, so b. Cost of manipulation. So we would like to have an efficient manipulation. And the first thing we've seen is that computing psi psi has a cost, which is actually, well, how do we compute the largest eigenvector here? We can use a power method. We've studied this during the first week. So we just have to take a vector, multiply it by this transfer matrix many, many times. But the cost of doing that, we just discussed, right? It's chi 3d. We just discussed how much it was to multiply this vector times this matrix. That's somewhere up there. So with cost independent of n, we can actually compute the norm of the state. Okay? Now, we can ask questions, other questions such as, well, okay, we have the norm of the state, but can we actually extract non-trivial expectation values from these infinite, from these answers for a possibly infinite system? So we would like to compute this here. All right, so let's write this. Again, we have to draw the tensor network for the bra and for the cat. And then we want to insert, somewhere we'll insert the local observable. Okay. So I'm going to assume now that lambda 1, the largest eigenvalue, has been set to 1 for the transfer matrix. And I'm going to argue that in the limit of large n, so this is n, the number of sites, but when we have a very large n, we can actually simplify this expression very much again. The reason is this. What is this expression? Is the trace, right, of the transfer matrix to the n minus 1 power. I'm just pointing out that here, again, we have the transfer matrix n minus 1 times. Yep.
Sorry, why was the cost of one chi cubed b and not chi phi?
In here?
Yeah.
Because, sure, this is a system with periodic boundary conditions, but all I want to do is to take this transfer matrix and find the largest, the dominant eigenvector by applying the power method. So I want to perform this transformation. Right? So you don't see here you don't see here more lex that would give rise to a larger power. Yeah? Okay, so we want to compute this expectation value, and we realize that it's the transfer matrix times this other object. So that's what we would like to compute. But again, we just take the transfer matrix to the nth power, or n minus 1 power. And this is nothing but lambda alpha from 1 to chi square, this coefficient to this eigenvalue to the nth minus 1 power, times the right eigenvector, alpha left eigenvector. Okay? So again, this can be approximated up to corrections that decay exponentially with the system size. So we're going to say that this is equal to right 1, left 1, the dominant eigenvectors, plus order, now it's lambda 2 over lambda 1, which is 1, to the power n minus 1. Okay? So this number here has modulus smaller than 1 by agreement. So this is decaying exponentially. So we can ignore it. And so we can write this basically as these two guys. I can represent this as two vectors like that. So I do this here, and I end up with the following expression. This is the left number 1. This is the right eigenvector, the dominant right eigenvector. And now I just put what I had before. OK? And so what I've done is I've reduced all this complicated tensor network to this very simple tensor network by using the fact that we have the transfer matrix to a very large power. And so this transfer matrix to a very large power can be replaced with right and left eigenvectors. And I take the trace, so I put here the left and here the right, and that's it. Okay? So how do we compute this? Well, I don't know what the cost is, but it's not it does not depend on n again. Okay. So, and the cost in this case, you can check that it's again on the order. It must be chi three. It's chi three times d. Okay. All right. So we've done something that is non-trivial, which is we've been able to represent wave functions for infinite systems, right? By using computational resources which are independent of the system size. Otherwise, we would not take the limit. Of an infinite system, but yeah, number of resources which are constant. Okay, and we can specify the wave function. We can compute the expectation values of local observables. In particular, then we can compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, assuming that it's translation invariant, and we can optimize this tensor network. All right. So what we have to see, and we'll start now and we'll continue tomorrow, is what type of properties this matrix product state will have.
I'm a little bit confused here with the notation.
Yeah.
You said before that a vector is basically a block with just one leg. So
these sure.
Diagrams, you're just joining two indices of the...
All the time when I'm calling, right. When I'm calling this a matrix or this a vector, what I'm assuming is that we're going to take these two indices, put them together. We're going to take these two indices and put them together, right? Yes, that's true. I mean, I'm just using the language that is common in the field, but it's true that I should be more careful with that. I call this a left, I call it a vector, and I call this a matrix in this sense. I'm assuming I'm putting together the two bond indices coming from the Bra and the Ket.
Another thing, when yesterday or the day before, we said that a good tensor network to reproduce the scaling of entanglement and have the right correlation functions. What about in these cases? How do these correlation functions behave?
Right, that's the next part of the lecture. Yes. So I want to discuss correlations and entanglement.
Naively, I just think the right eigenvector is actually the Hermitian conjugate of the left eigenvector.
That is not true. That is only true if your matrix is normal, which means it commutes with, if you have a matrix that commutes with its Hermitian conjugate, then you can eigenvalue decompose it using unitary matrices, which means left and right eigenvectors are Hermitian conjugate of each other. That's right.
No.
So if I was to look at this, if I look at the transfer matrix, so this is what I'm calling transfer matrix, right? If I put these indices together, then there is a matrix between those indices and these indices. And that matrix is not just normal. It's actually positive defined. So it's Hermitian and with a spectrum, a non-negative spectrum. But I'm not doing this. I'm looking at this product as a matrix between left and right indices, right? And so I cannot assume many properties there. Maybe if your system is invariant under reflections and the ground state has this property, maybe this matrix may end up being Hermitian or have some well-defined properties. But I cannot assume that in general.
For the random transfer matrix, if we compute the left or right eigenvector, I will always end up getting the orthogonal.
By orthogonal basis, two bases which are by orthogonal. So the only property they fulfill is this one up here. So I'm not saying that, say, left alpha left beta is equal to delta alpha beta. I'm definitely not saying that. Individually, each basis is just a set of linearly independent vectors. They are not even normalized. Okay? All right, so.
Are you going to give a concrete physical example?
I know where this question is coming from. So there will be examples in the tutorial tomorrow. Are you joining the tutorial tomorrow? Tomorrow at 3:30?
3:30.
Yes. So we'll investigate the specific tensors that we, so coefficients that we can put in the tensors to represent the specific wave functions. But maybe the point of what I'm explaining here today is that with these are properties that are prior to even optimizing the tensors. So we have not discussed, okay, this is the local Hamiltonian. I go through an optimization procedure. Here are the final values for, you know, all the coefficients in these tensors. No, no, we are looking at properties that do not depend at all on how you are going to use this wave function later on, this variational class of states. And so the properties that I want to discuss, I think I'll start tomorrow then, are the decay of correlations. And we'll see that correlations decay exponentially with the distance, as we wanted, as Andres wanted. And then for the entanglement entropy, we'll see that it saturates to a constant as well. Okay, so this will be one-to-one map between properties of matrix product states and properties of ground states of one-dimensional gap Hamiltonians. Excellent. We'll leave it here then.